Hello? Hello? Hello. Hello.
Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. I hope everybody's doing great. Let's look at any questions or clarifications, things from either of the two previous seminars that would be helpful for us to discuss. Anything at all? Anything you want me to expand on? Or amplify in any way from what we've talked about, or would you prefer just to move into the material today and save more time? I need a management of the background noise because I think that's my answer. I'm going to move into the presentation. Okay, we will have some time for discussion at the end. And again, I urge you to manage the background noise because whatever is picked up, you probably don't hear it on your system. So we are going to talk about in our third seminar about writing new software. Remember we talked about looking at understanding the algorithms that determine without even conscious awareness the behaviors, the emotions, and the attachment patterns and the stories that we have, including our money stories about what money means to us and how we use it. So we're going to continue this deconstruction, which is also the reconstruction of a new story, by looking at the roadmap system, the way to do this, one way to do this, and remember roadmap is the acronym for the steps. We're going to look at steps 4 and 5. Decide what to change and map changes of your money story. And just to reiterate, anytime you want to change a habit, look at the system and look at understanding the system in a specific way. And that's what I'm offering as the roadmap is a way of doing that and a way of working with yourself and with clients. So we discussed the concept of your money story, your relationship with money, and the first 3 steps of understanding and change, how to recognize, own, and assess your money story. So in this seminar, we're going to talk about the next 2 steps. Step 4, decide what to change in your money story. I'm going to describe a study, and some of you who have done some work with me before have heard me mention this study, but for some of you it may be new. I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day the subjects chose a different option from polls of contrasting behavior. Lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, polar opposites. And they would pick one of those and behave according to their choice the entire day. So an introverted person, for example, would choose to act as an extrovert for the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they had to stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They would eat something twice a week they had never eaten before, and twice a week they would read something they had never read before. So, after 4 months of doing this for a large number of volunteers. What do you think was the biggest change in the group? The remarkable finding, remarkable to me, was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, they almost all had not just kept the weight off, but continued to lose weight. And the researchers were initially baffled. This wasn't a diet. It was a study focusing on change and its impact. But what they found was that when they required people to change routine behavior, it made them actually think about choice, think about decisions, rather than just in the default mode, habitually doing something without consideration. They became aware that every behavior, each bite of food was a choice. So they could then reflect on whether that choice was in their best interest or not. So once becoming aware of actively making choices, you can decide to make the most informed and strategic choices possible. And remember, your identity is not your behavior or your habits. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will be harder to change. Every time a client identifies himself or herself by a habit, that's to me a coachable moment to look at how that's not an identity. You know, I'm a procrastinator, as if that's an explanation for putting off things rather than simply a descriptor of a number of choices. Every action is a choice. Every thought and feeling is a choice. Whatever we think, feel, and experience is what we choose each moment. So let's look at this just a little bit more. Last seminar, we discussed the equation, belief drives behavior, behavior drives performance. So for this step, decide what to change, I want to add an equation. It captures the principle that you either create your reality or agree to it. And that's something important to remember. As adults, whatever we experience, we either create or we agree to. Otherwise, we change it. Here's the equation. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience in life is a result of how you respond to an event in your life. Achievement is an outcome. It's a result of responding in certain ways. It's not what happens to us, but our response to what happens to us that makes the difference. So, this essential principle for ownership of your money story in adulthood, you either create or allow everything that happens to you. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. You didn't attend to marketing, and now your business is slumping. You've spent more than you've earned, so now you're in debt. Choice is also part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is a mindset with its own text and can sound like this. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I don't think I can do it. The absence of the awareness of choice limits possibility. Now, here's a kind of a footnote. Whatever you're doing that you feel you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior, such as spending beyond your means, to a process, such as debt, a certain kind of relationship, or to compromised results. Money is energy. Anyone addicted to anything has difficulty regulating energy. So here's another notion to consider as we look at deciding what to change. Obstacles and desires. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. To say that a different way, show me an obstacle and I'll show you a desire. Rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat an obstacle, simply consider not creating it. It's there when you create it. consider using your energy to generate something else instead. Now, there's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it seem safe to want it if you're afraid. Here's an example. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking fiercely at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. The cat in the next frame was at least as big and probably meaner looking than anything around. Definitely as big as the dog. So all of a sudden, in the middle of this ferocious bark, straining at its leash, the dog barking like, let me at him, the leash snapped. So the dog was free to go after the cat. He looked back, saw what happened, was astonished, scared to death. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then he could again safely strain at the leash and bark his fiery, just let me at him. Now, here's another example of this dialectic of obstacle and desire. When viewing a scene in a film you don't want to see, you cover your face with your hands as if to say, no, I can't look at this. But then the desire creeps in and you peek through your fingers at what you're drawn to see. The obstacle makes looking acceptable. So, when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, I can't find time to exercise. I can't put away any savings. Reflect on the underlying desire. And here's the principle that I believe you'll find useful again and again in professional coaching. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like to not create your obstacles. An example, the primary obstacles that people give for not participating in retirement plan include fear of finances, inertia, procrastination because of other pressing financial demands. Now, the way you frame an issue makes a great deal of difference. Here's an example of this effect. When companies automatically enroll their employees in retirement savings plans, the employee then has to opt out in order to not participate, to actually make a choice that says, I will not save for my future. So when it's automatic, it's initially 100%, then it levels to 86 to 94%. At companies where it isn't automatic and someone has to decide to choose to opt in, 20% participate, over a four-fold difference. So this may say the huge non-secret. You can set up your own automatic contributions to automatically deduct a set amount from your checking account each month to deposit into a retirement account. Make a good choice once, and you don't have to keep deciding. So let's look at change and the brain. This is crucial, I believe, to understand when we engage change. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. So let's first look at how the brain opposes change, and then how to use this information to facilitate successful change. One, people have knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. You have to be where your client is before you can then go someplace new. Two, this prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. A fact, a belief, an attachment pattern are all anatomical realities in the brain. They can't simply be removed or just overwritten by another better fact, or here's a better way to do that. They do, however, atrophy with disuse as other networks take their place. place other practiced experiences. So this is part of the gradual internal process of creating new neuronal networks and pathways and not entering the old ones, so that this is part of learning and unlearning combined. 3, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. So as we mentor and co-create change, we have to start with where the client is, not where we are. And people are not always aware of their prior knowledge and some of their behavior that may not be conscious may need to be looked at and understood together collaboratively. And 4, when changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, new connections are made in the brain, new maps are created. So, how does the brain actually oppose change? Since the brain has a mind of its own, we need to consider how our brains work in order to strategically plan change. Each of these precepts will help you craft your new money story and help you work with your clients to help them craft new stories in life or business. Now, this, I believe, is what can make you an exceptional coach to integrate the mind and brain sciences with strategic coaching. So let's look in very specific ways about how the brain opposes change. 1, change generates discomfort. Activities that we've repeated, that have become habits, have become hardwired in our brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation and to make routine behaviors easy. For example, we don't have to think about how to drive the same way to work each day. It becomes, after you do it enough, a default mode so you can think about other things or listen to an audiobook. This default mode is energy efficient and frees up the brain to do other things. But now, when a habit like this is confronted and has to change, the automatic pilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change to preserve the default habit. And the brain naturally resists change. To hardwire behavior saves energy, so to oppose what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense is a job description of the brain. Now, the promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. Beliefs can turn genes on or turn them off. I've heard him in person say this. Ray Kurzweil has written in his book, The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. He put it very simply. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. 2, change creates dissonance. We see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. The brain has an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors. This is the difference between what we expect and what we perceive. It registers as a sense in the brain that something's not quite right. So this portion of your medial frontal cortex has the job description to recognize and correct errors. Consider, for example, the emotional expense of debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is you have to pay more for it. Then the emotional expense of your mind and dissonance in your brain to recognize that spending is different from affording. You're spending money you don't have. Then you have to pay the interest, triple work. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. The good news, this neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior by responding to mistakes. Now, this is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or simply our brain's response to change itself. 3, of how the brain opposes change. The brain is a prediction machine. Let me tell you some numbers, if you have a pen. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. What's missing? Now, the usual response is 3 and 6, maybe multiples of 3. Well, consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. An example, a company has increased profits 26 quarters in a row, and projected earnings this quarter are 24 cents a share, another growth. They announce earnings, though, still a growth, but instead of 24 cents a share, 23 cents a share. In the first 5 minutes, they lose $1.5 billion in market value. This is a true story. So what changed in those 5 minutes? The company's intrinsic value and balance sheet, or the mindset of the investors? J. Paul Getty said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now, you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of a lot of jokes. You list 2 things, then a 3rd non sequitur. Setup, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge at times to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. So we need to be sure we predict, that we envision the right things. Another way the brain opposes change, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither. They both are likely to backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats may work short-term but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. It's like focusing on something negative. You get what you focus on. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually focuses on something negative in reverse. It raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns having to do with lateness. We assume people are going to receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. If they did, they could simply get information on the internet and we'd be out of business as coaches. In fact, being told what to do can result in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. The brain's error detection mechanism says that ain't right. So This is why we need to be careful about telling our clients what to do, besides it not working. 5, motivation is not essential. Now, think about this for a minute. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. Think about the people you've heard say, maybe even clients, maybe said yourself, well, I just need to get motivated to work out regularly. I need to get motivated to have a better diet or to lose weight or to join a program. You don't need to be motivated. In fact, that can be distracting if you're having that as a precondition. There are only 2 things that are necessary for change. Motivation is not one of them. It's having a plan and sticking to it. I work with a number of pro athletes. They're not motivated to go to the gym every day in off season, but they do because they know it's part of what they do in order to do what's next. Same way with professional actors. You don't have to be motivated. You just have to have a plan and stick to it. You don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. You just set up an automatic claim payment or participation plan. So you just have a plan and stick to it. You only need to make a good choice one time. The quality of many future years will be affected, whether that's working out every day or having a savings plan. 6, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, brain chemicals, dopamine and adrenaline, are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is why self-talk is limited. Change your thoughts to change your behavior. That's not going to work as soon as emotion gets activated. When emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. I know you've heard this. One of the philosophers of the 21st century put it really simply. Everybody's got a plan till they get punched in the mouth. I didn't say great philosopher. That was Mike Tyson. When there is possibility of a reward, dopamine is released to produce an excited state in response to an anticipation of a reward. When you anticipate spending money, a risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine or blackjack table. So here's what we know now. It's not the reward, as we once thought, that causes the spike in dopamine, the pleasure chemical. It's the anticipation of reward. When gamblers were studied, they were hooked up to an fMRI. When they approached the slot machine, before they ever touched it, they had a spike in dopamine. Secondly, the less predictable a reward is, the longer and stronger the dopamine neurons fire, creating more of a natural high. If a laboratory mouse is given regular predictable reward for punching a lever, the behavior stops quickly when the food pellet rewards stop. But if the food pellets are infrequent and unpredictable, the mouse will keep pushing the lever almost indefinitely and actually to exhaustion. This behavior is not confined to laboratory mice. Watch a bank of slot machines in Vegas, and you'll see the same scenario complete with lever pulling and reward pellets. The moral here, people easily fall into the unconscious pursuit of dopamine and its accompanying pleasure despite the obviously illogical downside. That's why any addiction is a promise that's never kept. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of stress short term can actually enhance learning. The time window on this, though, is up to about 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially for 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. So this means that with sustained stress, people can make bad, emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy I believe that we can have is regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. This is done by enhancing self-reflection. This is exactly what we do as part of the process in mentor coaching. 8, the ways the brain opposes change. Closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty often as they get older. Now, the major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place and one position get most entrenched. I've done a weekend retreat with my buddy we alternate his ranch and my ranch, of people who are business owners or CEOs within a year of retirement. It's called What's Next Exec, because people who have been doing this for so long don't exactly know some of the basic things about, you know, doing business. About, I mean, if they've been in a corporate setting, even CEOs or business owners have not done things that they may need to do to set up a very different kind of business or a different contribution, consulting, charity work, any number of things. And they kind of know that after about 2 months, they're going to get tired of playing golf every day. So this is their next job, to make a career transition for their next career or contribution. It's a considerable decision and transition. So an example of a place I see this resistance in coaching of change or of closure to novelty is in family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he founded 38 years ago to his two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles, relationships, and job descriptions. Now, these last two principles, I think, are absolutely huge in strategizing change. 9, neurogenesis, the making of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure to co-create, stimulate, thinking, challenge, story busting. This is exactly what we do every session with our clients. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with two things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. And these findings have been replicated recently in non-invasive studies in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. Almost the same percentages of increase in the number of cells in the hippocampus that has to do more than any other part of the brain with memory and creativity. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the vital part of the brain, the hippocampus, having to do with creativity and memory, declines with chronic stress. And 10, the last aspect, neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. Rezoning, developing cortical real estate. Here's an example, a very simple example. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that gave an upside-down image. Everything was exactly reversed, 24 hours a day. So they had to adjust everything they did, to think through every even small movement, because up was down, Everything was reversed. Then, about day 25, they each noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to anymore. Their brains had rewired to develop new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts in the same headgear were given a day off out of the helmet, out of the helmets for an entire 24-hour period at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. I think that emphasizes the role of consistency and continuity. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Let's look now at step 5, mapping changes. A man approached J.P. Morgan, it's a true story, held up an envelope and said, "Sir, in my hand I hold a guaranteed formula for success, which I will gladly sell you for $25,000. Now, to me, $7 is a lot of money currently, but $25,000 back when this happened, the turn of the century, was huge. "Sir," J.P. Morgan replied, "I don't know what's in the envelope, but if you show it to me and I like it, I give you my word as a gentleman, I'll pay you what you ask." Well, considering the options, the man agreed to the terms. He handed over the envelope. J.P. Morgan opened it, extracted a single sheet of paper, gave it one look, and handed the piece of paper back to the man, and wrote him a check for $25,000. There were two sentences on the entire page. "Every morning, write a list of things that need to be done that day. Do them. Have a plan and stick to it." We could have made big bucks. Now, there are 6 crucial elements to map change. I want to talk about how to understand and incorporate each of these 6 as a kind of an outline, a system to master your money story. 1, regulate states of mind. This is really significant. The additional resource, and I'm not going to go into a lot of explanation here, but there is, and I've mentioned this before, a 35-minute webinar on the homepage of my website. It's a free webinar. You sign up and you have access to it on master states of mind. It really covers the fundamentals of mastering states of mind, which I believe is the most important success principle that we can have. Here's an illustration. Dr. Vernon Smith won a Nobel Prize in economics by demonstrating how market bubbles are created. He did a series of trading experiments with economic graduate students. They were informed the fair value of a security was $3. Now, these traders knew the actual worth of the security. That's a, if you think about it, a significant advantage over the Wall Street situation, because the value of a security is determined by whatever anybody's willing to offer, because it's not a market, really, but an auction. So, what happened in price bidding when they knew the actual worth of the security? They still, once they got bidding, ran the price up significantly past the $3 mark. When other traders in experiments stopped paying a premium, the laboratory market crashed. Most of the initial times they did it, the first times, even with economics graduate students, the price got to around the $6 range, about double what its actual value was. Then Smith did a second experiment, same group, same kind of auction, and they formed another smaller bubble. Less extravagant this time, but into the low $4 of an analogous situation. It wasn't until the third time around that the investors wised up enough to stay within the security's actual value, even though they knew it from the start. when Dr. Smith repeated this experiment with finance professors and other economic specialists, they formed the same kind of bubbles, not as extreme, but same bubbles, for two times, followed by two crashes, until they stuck to the value. States of mind are like software programs. They're a mind-body state that determine how we perceive and then how we process information. And we all have a set of different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention. A key element is to be aware of our different states of mind, to know what state works best for what purpose. For example, creative writing versus editing. Two different states of mind, two different parts of the brain. So when someone's in an emotional state, they're overbalanced toward right brain response, the feeling brain. In extreme stress, the emotional brain can even hijack and hold hostage the intellectual logical brain. So what do? Your brain's working against you. When you're in any state of upset or just on tilt in any way, the first order of business is to regulate feelings and restore a cool state, the balance of right and left brain. Poker players call it tilt. When you lose big or when you win big, you're emotional, and that inclines you to respond to that emotion, to play your last hand or your leftover emotion. So with any kind of tilt, break the state of mind. Have a way to get grounded and centered. The webinar will review what we've talked about already about recognizing emotional triggers and having a systematic way to get grounded and centered, to then respond when your state of mind is balanced. The number two element to map changes: the power is in the focus. This is what we know from neuroscience and quantum physics, and is what is behind the law of attraction. Thoughts have a frequency, an energy field. Focus selects a frequency. It's like saying all the channels of a radio or satellite TV are available, but we choose the channel, the frequency we want, out of hundreds of possibilities. We each transmit and receive a frequency for each of our states of mind, for each of our thoughts. If you want to change something in your life, change your frequency, the channel, change your thoughts. Now, the bad news, if you think about what you don't want, it keeps coming up over and over again. According to quantum physics, we each generate energy frequencies or vibrations. We project energy in our emotions and thoughts that are the source of what and who we attract, as well as the basis of our sense of well-being. The quantum Zeno effect, Z-E-N-O, says the mental act of attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. This is the importance of focus. With consistent focus and repetition, these chemical links actually become stable changes in the brain. The brain rewires, in other words. Now, here's another paradigm that quantum physics offers us. In addition to our individual energy field, there's a collective field, and you can tap into and resonate with this field, the quantum field of possibility. Einstein called this the unified field theory. He said, basically, the individual human mind and body are bundles of energy that interact with another person's energy field, as well as the collective energy field of a group. This is how we can read people, focus our choices, and determine the flow of our future. And for somebody who predicted black holes decades before there was any proof, I'd sort of listen to this guy. So what do to tap into this collective field? We project energy frequencies like a magnet, and we attract what we focus on. If we focus on the negative and on problems, this is be what we create. If we focus on the positive and on solutions, that's what we align our energy field to create. So This concept offers explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus is more effective than a problem focus. These brain connections literally become mind maps and then influence the reality that we see. The paradox is we don't attract what we want, but we attract what we focus on, what we align our energy field. Even if it's reversing a negative, you know, I want to be out of debt. The focus is still on debt. Focusing on scarcity attracts scarcity. Focusing on prosperity aligns your energy to pursue prosperity. And the reason it works is this. Your unconscious does not register positive or negative, just the focus. It's kind of like a print or negative is the same image. Your unconscious is that image. So the power of focus is whatever you attend to or focus on, you align yourself to create. So be sure you focus on the right thing, not just reversing what you don't want. So here are some bad examples. I want to get out of debt. Focuses on debt. I want to lose weight. Focuses on overweight. And here's one that's kept a lot of dry cleaners busy. I want to be really careful and not spill anything on this new outfit. 3, visualize changes. Here's the prototype study that initiated a whole number of studies that have subsequently demonstrated how powerful visualization is to rewire the brain. Basketball players at Ohio State University were divided into 3 groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. Another group, 30 minutes of practice daily at free throws. And a third group, they imagined shooting perfect free throws, at least for 5 minutes daily for 30 days. They were then tested at the end of 30 days. The first group, no practice, 0% improvement. The second group, actual practice for 30 minutes daily, 24% improvement. And the third group, practiced by visualization only for only 5 minutes, 23% improvement. And subsequent studies have increased that average to show that visualization alone, when it's done in an informed way, can actually surpass the actual practice. Now, it's not to replace it. On brain imaging, the same sequence of firing occurs with visualization as with actually shooting. So, create an image of your goal and live into it. Create a plan and do it. Visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The experience actually changes the brain. A vision serves as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. 4, insight changes the brain. At the moment of an insight, an aha experience, a complex new set of neural connections is created. 3 different parts of the brain light up on fMRI scans during a moment of insight, an aha moment. Consider when someone is given information, a directive, an order, facts. Nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. Now, as important as this insight-induced change is, the sustained attention is what hardwires it in the brain circuits. 5, take action. The world will not pay you for what you know. It will pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important. Payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan and set it in motion. It may not be perfect, but they can self-correct and keep moving forward, learning from their mistakes and producing results. Always putting deliberate practice for whatever performance into an output channel, and then looking objectively, self-reflecting on the outcome resulting. Now, this can be why a group of the brightest people anywhere with all kind of degrees can plan and figure out something, but struggle to make it happen. Meanwhile, the guy who almost finished the second semester of the first year of community college owns a bunch of real estate on the west side of town. And six, transform identity. This is what we're going to talk about that I think is so important, especially in our next seminar, because this is what makes change permanent. When we incorporate in an evolving model of ourselves and who we are, the transformation that we create, it becomes our identity. So it becomes the default mode. And the most powerful force of the human psyche is we always return to our identity. So if you do a behavior and you don't incorporate that behavior into who you really are, the behavior's gone. It's a memory. And we're going to look more about how to specifically and systematically do this in mentor coaching in step 7 next seminar, program new identity. That's the P of the roadmap. So here's just in summary, an application of steps 4 and 5 combined, deciding and mapping change. So the most common ways that we're short-sighted in our decision-making is we may choose a small amount of something right now instead of a larger amount in the future. Here are some possibilities to counter these tendencies. Neuroeconomist Ben Seymour at University of College in London showed that imagining a future purchase can have the same effect in the brain as getting it. Another, saving is easier when it's for something specific that we can envision. It's easier and more specific to create a distinct vision for each goal, for a vacation, for college tuition, for a second home. Tangibly calculate the cost of debt so that it becomes a real here and now figure so that you can compare. Concretely represent the magic of compound interest. Figure out, for example, what the money you spend would be worth in 5 years, in 10 years, at retirement. Here's a really simple example. If you, beginning at age 20, invest $1.50 a day, based on the average stock market growth since 1926, by age 65, you'd have $1 million. If you wait until age 21 instead of 20, the difference is $109,000. If you invest $2,000 a year in an IRA beginning at age 18, then stop all investments by age 30, by age 65, that will be worth $1 million. Here's another related aspect. Credit cards segment the anticipatory pleasure of spending in the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center of the brain, from the pain of future payment, a very different part of the brain. Then our optimism bias may even kick in and we make repayment and abstraction. Well, that's next month. I don't have to worry about that. Rationalization can heighten the proportion and make it an elastic boundary. Pay off in 3 months stretches to 6 or 12. Increasing abstraction of money emotionally distances the obligation of debt. A faceless credit card company can become a vague authority. And people will spend, on average, 23% more when they pay by credit card than when they pay by cash or check. That's the advantage of an abstraction and only dealing with the pleasure of spending and making repayment a different part of the brain that creates some pain when you give up something that is yours and valued, something in the future. Now here's a recent economic study showed that credit card holders are actually consciously aware of only $4 of every $10 they owe. not just, you know, they were off a little bit, but actually unaware. That has been called a secret sin because of the shame attack. Here's what one expert had to say. Uncle Junior, to his nephew Tony Soprano, "You know, your father and me started that poker game over 30 years ago. We were talking one day about how credit card companies, you know, they work their angle, how they don't care what you bought as long as you don't pay it all at once. They juice you to death, and you thank them for letting you have a card. You'd rather be juiced than pay it all at once. It's a certain kind of player. That's why we call it the executive game. We render money an abstraction and deceive ourselves. Well, I can do it on my credit card, so it won't be an immediate expense. And as Richard Medley said, free money makes you stupid. Remember this from everything you've heard. Right now, saving and the future are both abstractions. There will be a time when they both become very real." Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested in any thoughts, questions, or anything you'd like to add or ask. How practical is this sounding for dealing with clients, dealing with your own stories? Let me ask more specifically.
No. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Dave. I have my phone on mute. This is Carolyn. I just have to say a couple of things. One, this is really, I took this course initially with the intent of using it as a, you know, a complementary, a compensating amenity to my regular coaching practice. But I have to say, as part of the process, and I know I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, as part of the process, it's been a real, I think, discovery process for kind of coaching myself around the issues or around just the topic of money, that, you know, typically people don't talk about. You know, nobody talks about how much money they have or, and that sort of thing, but more importantly, about the way you think about money. And quite honestly, I didn't think I had a particular way or pattern of thinking about it, but as part of this discovery in this course and just, you know, talking with others, I realized that, yeah, I did. And I'm happy to say, and I released that pattern. I recognized my role in all of this, and I released that, and I'm going to change the way I think about it, because
well,
I think it's
a progress note. Thank you, Carolyn. And this is simply a systematic way to look at any story. I know we're focusing on money, but it's a way to look at things that are just usual default patterns that we may not think about or that may be blind spots or unconscious biases or simply attributions, because we all have software systems that were developed in an earlier time and place, and they work really well in most instances to very quickly process and understand things without having to go through the entire process of discovery every time. But then sometimes those software programs were actually tailored for an earlier time and place and have become outdated or have had downloads from important others of stories or aspects or perceptions that may compromise in some way. So it's a useful process to look at, and it's simply one way of this, but it's, you know, so if you've had that experience, terrific. I'm very pleased to hear that, and thank you. Anyone else, would you summarize in a sentence, so far, what would you say your major takeaway or aha is from what we've talked about so far?
Hi, Dave. This is Joy.
Yeah, thanks. Go ahead.
Think about what you're thinking about.
Okay.
That's a good one.
that's good. That makes the, you know, 10 words or less cut, so that's great. Yeah. ourselves, for our stories, and for our clients, is to develop empathy, to really listen from inside and experience, and thereby create self-awareness so that we can self-reflect. And all we then have to do is see what works and what doesn't work, and be honest and rigorous about it. And that's what we want to do with a client, is get to the point to build a working alliance, the first developmental phase of working with a client, so that we can get away with saying whatever we need to say in a collaborative way, so that nothing has to be omitted and everything can be looked at and understood and integrated in an evolving process. So that's a great and succinct way to say it. We've got less than a minute. Any other major takeaway or thing that you've gleaned from this? Anyone? Well, if you think about it, fire away an email. Those of you, I know a number of you have mentioned that you weren't able to attend and will be listening to the replay, so I'll be interested in any input, any questions, and we'll reserve some time at the beginning of our next seminar, our final seminar, to look at any questions or comments you have or anything you'd like to elaborate a bit about at the beginning of next time. So thank you all very much. Thanks for the feedback and the interchange. I value that very much. I hope you have a great rest of the week, and I look forward to picking up right here next time. Bye now. See you guys.
Thank you. Have a good evening. Bye. My God, it's crap. Really? I'm tired. All right. So. Find that stuff about the vibration and the frequency, all that stuff. Is it? Mm-hmm.